The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Michael Brooks is the host of The Michael Brooks Show, the co-host of The Majority Report, and the author of the upcoming Zero Books title, Against the Web, a cosmopolitan socialist answer to the IDW and the New Right. In this episode, we discuss the most pressing news items from about 2 weeks back. It's Monday, September 2nd, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I also want to announce at this point that just today, I debated Destiny on Twitch, which I understand is some sort of video game thing. So if you are interested in watching me debate a gamer with years of experience debating, go check that out. This week's podcast is available for everyone. Our patrons get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll be able to access at least one or the other podcast each week. Patrons also receive access to our new video series called The History of Communism. The next one's coming up soon. And people who join the book club, who donate at a higher level, $15 a month, get access to a Zero Books title every month and are invited to join our online discussion group. Starting in September, we'll also be running a series called the Close Reading Series, which I will talk to the author once a week or maybe more and release a video of that on Patreon for the Zero Books Club members. So you'll be able to read the book, watch interviews with the author, more than one, and then discuss the book at the end, hopefully with the author again. The music you're listening to right now is titled Chiptune Retro on the Audioblock Stock Audio site. It's delightful, isn't it? But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Brooks and I discuss the news. But Michael, let me just ask you a question to get this whole ball rolling. What do you think is the most important story of the day for the left to think about? Let me give you the three that are bothering me. There's the rumors of the recession. There's the Epstein murder, it looks like now. Not because the suicide story is falling apart. And then there's still the, we've got the Proud Boys coming to Portland on Saturday. And there was the shooting in El Paso, which I tried to mostly not even think about, like ignore, like just terribly. But I just didn't want to have a social media response to it, you know. But yeah, those are the stories of the day for me.
My three are the ongoing demonstrations in Honduras, because I think that it's very important to understand the coup that in fact we did back in 2009 and helped work to legitimize internationally, that removed Manuel Zelaya from office. And that is inseparable from understanding the dynamics of migration. And, you know, it's inseparable from understanding U.S. foreign policy. So I do think in general that U.S. foreign policy, both in terms of the innate, need to reform and change it, it's disturbing how much of, people really don't see it as a kind of system that flows into their own lives. And it really does. So Honduras would be one thing. I think the media bias against Bernie is really important. And not just because I'm a you know, full-fledged, fervent Sanders supporter, but because I actually think there's some very valuable lessons there more broadly about how institutions work and capitalism. And I actually, it's funny because I always have an enormous, you know, appreciation for Noam Chomsky, but I found, you know, there's a fair amount of things with Chomsky that just, you know, he's not necessarily the first book that I reach for, as it were, but I actually think the consent model actually really does hold up because it was a very thoughtful model. You know, it was about enculturating. It was about, you know, it's an institutional critique. It's not a conspiratorial one. And we need more of that.
You and I agree about one of the three.
Let me just say one of the things that I think is fascinating about the recession talk, and this is something Ken Klippenstein tweeted. He said, it's astonishing how many millennials, and of course, look, you know, yes, if there's a serious recession, there's much bigger implications than this, but he was saying it's incredible how many millennials kind of are like, well, I have no savings and no sort of stability anyways. So, you know, shrug my shoulders kind of thing.
Because I think the people who would be shrugging their shoulders at first, but then maybe leading kind of campus revolts or protests, if we did have a repeat of 2008, wouldn't be millennials now. It would be Zoomers. You know, that'd be my kids. And their friends. I'm not sure how many Zoomers there are out there. I don't know what the demographics are. But the millennials lived through 2008. I don't know. Some of them were teenagers. Some of them were adults at the time. And for us to have another economic crisis now, when we've only really been in a full recovery mode for maybe the last 5 years... Like, you know, we had a 5-year ramp up and then a not so great recovery. I mean, but look, Trump could run on economic hardship in 2016, right? He could run as the guy who was saying, they're cooking the unemployment numbers and people are suffering and there aren't any jobs. And now Trump's era, all 2.5 years of it, have been this time of great economic recovery. So if there's a recession, does that mean that it was a bubble? And, you know, are we really going to see another deep dip? Could we be looking at a depression? You know, I don't know. Like, I want to do more, go back to the books and hit the books and think about, you know, just what the tariffs and the trade war mean and all that kind of thing. But I'm worried about it. But I can understand that people who feel like they don't have anything don't care. I remember my friends who were low-wage workers in 2008, you know, living paycheck to paycheck in little studio apartments here in Portland. A few of these guys who've been, you know, that way for 10, 20 years just said, yeah, we'll be fine. It's all the middle-class people who are really worried. But we'll still have the same shit.
Well, I do. I actually wonder, you know, that's the other very disturbing thing, right? Is that short of, and maybe not even short of some type of, you know, serious depression, in which case we would be very worried about the political implications. But short of that, it just seems to me that we are already structurally so maldistributed that, you know, we really do have, we have parts of the country that have an unbelievable amount of wealth processing through it. And then it's still in, you know, extremely unequal ways. But there's a huge amount of wealth and, you know, and it can sort of, it does in certain very narrow ways trickle down. But it's still unsustainable for most people. You know, obviously I live in New York, right? Like, I mean, you see this dynamic all the time. And then there's parts of the country that are just that are desolate and shot. And I actually think that, see, the part of Trump in 2016 where he was the one who connected on the real economic condition of the country, I think it wasn't even about like ranting about the real unemployment rate or whatever. I think it was actually very much, I mean, one was, you know, he would do the racist stuff with Chicago and everything. That was obviously a big part of it. But when he would go out and talk about opioids and how the middle of the country was totally, you know, bombed out. And then, of course, you know, just as they do, of course, all of the fucking nerds in the Democratic Party came back with like, well, actually, the economy is in recovery. And, you know, I think that what was, and of course, he was right. You know, he was absolutely right. If you were talking about, you know, any number of towns in Pennsylvania or West Virginia or whatever, I mean, you can see large swaths of the country that are just underinvested in. They're totally diminished, and they frankly even just have super depressing landscapes, basically. Like I remember, you know, I went to college at Bates in Lewiston, Maine, and definitely one of those sort of like, relatively speaking, you know, very privileged, you know, top 20 liberal arts, private liberal arts college, a lot of parents dropping their kids off in Volvos and whatever. And it was, and Lewiston was a town that was not doing well by any stretch of the imagination. And it really was a place that was like a mill town, you know, in the river, by the river in Maine, and it never recovered. I don't even know what they used to make at those mills, right? And there was actually, in some ways, I mean, there was a Somali refugee community, which led to like a serious surge in Klan activity there. There was like actual Klan activity. And you saw like the whole downtown, it was starting to change a touch, but you basically had a downtown, which actually, you know, if there was more of a base around it, I guess you could have probably started to quite easily gentrify, because it did actually have all these like really nice old brick buildings that everybody likes, but it was basically totally empty and hollowed out and very, you know, done economically. And then outside of it, off of the highway, you just had these long strips of, you know, of Applebee's and McDonald's and car washes and gas stations. And, you know, honestly, even aesthetically, it just, you know, I'm not some great snob. Like, you know, I don't need a whole lot of flash or whatever. But honestly, objectively, looking at that landscape is fucking depressing. And you could just, you know, and so I think a lot. So if there was a big recession, it would be worse. But I think the fundamental dynamics are really already in place, frankly. I do.
The thing about being for the poor, the conditions we're in right now, let's just call them like neoliberalism. The difficulty is that even when things are going well, the poor and the working class pay for it in their own blood. So as an example, I know two men in their 60s. They're actually the same people who I was thinking of who 10 years ago were saying, we'll be fine. We're used to it. Both of them now are out of a home, because they've been renting the same in like houses, like little rooms and houses for 20, 25 years. And the market is really, really good right now in real estate. And they, both of their houses have been sold out from under them. And they're both on Social Security only. And they're both not sure where the hell they're going to go, because they sort of had rent control, not exactly. But, you know, they knew the landlord. The landlord knew them. They weren't paying anywhere near the real rate of rent for their little rooms. And now they have to hit the, you know, road and find a new place to live at the age of 67. And it's not good. And one of them's actually in a psych ward.
Oh, God. Well, yeah. No, and I guess my question would be, and I look. It's, I'm not, in a way it's a useless, and well, not useless, but in a way, I mean, again, if there's a recession, that's really bad for a lot of people. So I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying that it seems to me that the barbell is already so here in the economy that I like, like even the people that I know, frankly, and particularly if they're in the Northeast, that you would think of as middle class and might be, you know, hit by a recession, they are really upper middle class, frankly. Like, I don't, you know, I think that reality of like a country of poor people and wealthy people is very true. And then I think there is a segment of people who would probably still fall into the middle class. And paradoxically, in some ways, they might even be defined as relatively affluent and wealthy. And in other ways, they're super stretched to even be where they are, even with, you know, the relative of all of their privilege. I find like, I feel like even relative to when I was a teenager growing up, it seemed and felt like there were more people around where it was like, oh, well, you know, they make, you know, I don't know, $80,000 a year together as a couple. They've got a couple of kids and, you know, it's nothing fancy, but things are really okay. I don't see that at all anymore. I actually more kind of see like his two people are together or whatever, and maybe they make like, you know, $150,000 together and things are kind of okay. Now, granted, obviously, you know, it depends where you are in the country, but on the other hand, yeah, well, that's true. But on the other hand, I mean, I think that's another part of the economy is I don't like, even where I grew up in Western Massachusetts, right, which is definitely, relatively speaking, a much nicer place to be than a lot of places in the country in terms of, you know, the natural environment. There's colleges and decent schools and, you know, it's got a lot going for it. But frankly, like outside of academia or a couple of jobs that you would mostly have to commute to outside of the area, maybe some hospitals or insurance companies or whatever. And then obviously, you know, there's a little bit of a population and economic activity. So there are some doctors and lawyers and shop owners and whatnot. But if you wanted to say, hey, I want to have a really decent, you know, secure, whatever sort of job, but I don't want to have to live in a major metropolitan area, I'd like to live in a place like Western Massachusetts. I don't really actually think there's jobs like that. Well, those are more of the, you know, less of the sort of more kind of white collar jobs I was talking about. I mean, I think those jobs still exist and people still get them and it's great. But I think that those are, you know, savaged by austerity and cuts and they're less plentiful than they used to be. And that's, you know, that's another thing. But those jobs are great. I mean, whatever one thinks of a broader critique of unions, blah, 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 we can talk about this and that, that's fine. But there's no way out of any version of our predicament that doesn't involve a profoundly, you know, powerful labor and union presence. So we certainly need to be fighting for those public sector jobs. I mean, there's no doubt about it, but they've been cut significantly. That's a save. The last thing I'll say, I mean, that's funny because that type of thing, and it's so under assault, but that's a savior of a certain working and middle class in New York, that, you know, a young person could actually still get a job at the subway or whatever as a conductor, you know, get a really good, really important job that still gets you in a public sector union. The fact that still exists here is the only thing that makes this, you know, still somewhat.
Yeah. The people I used to hang around with in the 90s. They went in two directions. Well, three. They're either, you know, in a psych ward right now, or or like in some sort of like post office work, nursing, that kind of position. My wife's a nurse now, or you know, they're, you know, in media, and like I knew some guy who's ended up in CNBC, and is a producer for a while. So, or people went into New York publishing and stuff like that. But so it's weird how but it's all the same milieu, right? It's all the little bohemian milieu of downtown Portland from 1992. Right, but anyway, but to the Jeffrey Epstein thing, because I may be thinking, maybe I think too much, like too symbolically or too like think of metaphorically, but it feels like if you have a recession and you have the Epstein
murder, then like the bottom is falling off of society or something like that, you know, like the bottom's falling out from beneath us. So there's nothing solid in our institutions anymore. It's all corrupt. It's rotted away. But what do you think about Epstein? How significant is he in terms of what he says about the political class?
I mean, it's funny because I'm like, you know, a couple of days ago when people were saying like, you know, this doesn't necessarily need to be a murder, I was like, okay, I'm not saying definitively anything, but let's not, you know, like, please, let's not discount that. So even if somehow he miraculously committed suicide, and honestly, I mean, I actually think the most, if you really wanted to stay within the sort of like realm of not going too far, which I'm not saying you should at all, you could say, like, you know, Jeffrey Epstein might have wired a guard money himself to let himself commit suicide, right?
That his bones in his neck were broken, that generally that indicates being strangled rather than hanging yourself.
That indicates being strangled, yeah. I mean, look, I think that I realize every time something like this happens, it's hard for me to kind of grok in a certain way, because I feel like on one hand, I'll be in a lot of conversations where I'm the person saying like, no, like, we actually can't elect Bernie Sanders president. You know, there actually is a lot of opportunity to work and sort of steer the ship in a different way. And I do have, you know, confidence and faith in some areas. And I also think that, you know, institutions are hegemonic and powerful, but there's a lot of contradiction inside them. And then on the other hand, I mean, sometimes I look around and it's like, I'm amazed at what people are shocked by. I mean, to me, it's like, yeah, of course there are people, you know, like in finance and politics and so on, who are child predators. And the direction that I would be more, you know, in some ways, what I think is what's getting me more in my old, you know, my frame of, I don't want to call it conspiratorial, because some of these things are just real. You know, Operation Gladio was a real thing. I think that Jeffrey Epstein is definitely some type of intelligence asset. I think it was some type of intelligence operation. I think it was probably about accumulating blackmail on a number of influential people. And I think that, you know, it's like it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, just like it shouldn't be a surprise if we had a recession. I wonder, you know, that's my tension, is I feel like somehow the sort of the people who are, you know, the idealists and the technocrats and the people who believe in the Democratic Party or whatever, the dogs and the house on fire saying everything's okay. And also the people who are like pulling their eyes out, going like, now we'll know the truth and the whole thing will be revealed. I just don't get either of those mindsets. You know, to me, it's like we live in a sort of hyper decadent collapsing empire. Like, yes. I mean, I don't, you know, when Cornel West talks about living in a decaying empire that is spiritually sick, to me, I don't think that that's like a rhetorical flourish. I think that's one of the plainest, most profound statements of truth in our time.
Yeah, but, right? But what makes us spiritually sick? I mean, is it too much wealth? Is it not enough wealth? I mean, the way I generally think about this is that that when we go into crisis, that's when the elites become vicious. Not because it's when there's an economic crisis, then you can't just invest and grow. I mean, it never works for the working class to just, oh, you know, make the pie bigger or make the pie higher, as George Bush would have said, right? That never works for the working class. But It does work for the capitalist class to some degree to just expand, grow. And when everything starts to shrink, that's when they fight with each other and things get really vicious. That's why there are world wars. You know, that's why that's always kind of going on as well between nations. I worry about the recession on top of this because I worry that the political system as it is going to become truly barbaric, not just beneath the surface. Obviously it already has, right? Like I'm 10 years out of date here, but
that's great. I mean, again, this is another one of these real dialectics, Doug, is it's like, you know, I mean, what's happening in Kashmir is such a great illustration of this, but obviously you could do a bunch of comparisons in the United States, but it's such a vivid example because if you're aware of India, you know that Kashmir has always been one of the most hyper-militarized places on Earth. The Indian military has been accused for decades of engaging in just rampant and serious systemic rights violations on a fundamental level. And this is applied to both Congress and BJP governments, right? So we've always been in barbarism. And Narendra Modi saying we are going to rip the Constitution, deploy 30,000 additional paramilitaries. Yeah, that's a Band-Aid coming off. And I find myself coming, you know, in conversations emphasizing different things depending on who my interlocutor is. So some people it's Jesus Christ, wake the fuck up and stop thinking about, you know, Obama and Trudeau and whoever is going to come save you. This whole system is horrific. It's exhausted. It's done. And it was profoundly damaging to most people. And then, you know, the other sort of like, you know, what's the difference with Trump and Obama? And, you know, all the differences is literally, you know, the president nodding and winking to, you know, nationalists, among other things. I mean, that is a profound difference. It has huge cultural implications. This one is a really stupid one, but, you know, obviously I've watched as all of my analysis and others' analysis on Brazil has been just like endlessly vindicated by that reporting from Avajato Weeks. And, you know, one thing that you'll hear, you know, sometimes people occasionally will say like, oh, you know, Lula, you know, the PT governments weren't as good as they could have been on the Amazon. It's like, well, first of all, they actually in some ways are pretty good, frankly. Secondly, no doubt, of course, they could have been better. And thirdly, is that really what you want to foreground where you actually have a motherfucker who's literally trying to destroy and give away to, let's be specific, Canadian mining companies, Australian and American logging companies and mining companies, you know, the world's second prime carbon absorber outside of Papua New Guinea. I wouldn't say this is a time to try to make some kind of pedantic point about, you know, a previous government. So, yeah.
So I'm sorry, I kind of got stuck on the world collapsing in my head. But let's try to be positive here for a second. And yeah, I do. I need to meditate for sure. So when you look at Bernie Sanders, because that's the thing. That was the other big story that you thought was important. And it's important. Must be important partly because you think if Sanders was elected, that would be a blow against, that would push against the direction we're going. That would actually maybe be the beginning of a shift in a different direction. That would be an improvement, that we could see things get a lot better, that the decay would fall off and we would have something other than a decaying empire around us. Not like overnight, but that could happen. But my question is, one, what do you think the chances are for Sanders right now? I guess that's just like asking you to look into a crystal ball. You can't really say. But two, what would you say the best case scenario is if Sanders was elected? And if Corbyn manages to hold on to power, and if Lula or his party can gain ascendancy again, or, you know, if the forces on the left that exist in the world started to rally around, what do you think the best case scenario is in the next 5 years?
Well, first of all, I do think he can win. I think he can. I think that it will be quite difficult, but I think he definitely can win. And I think we need to also actually have some, you know, learn some optimism here. You know, he's a presidential front runner with a ground game and grassroots and organic support that nobody else has. And it's significant that he's got that.
I think he can win if it comes down to a race between him and Biden for the nomination. I think he can beat Biden for the nomination. I really do.
Yeah, I think he can beat any of them for the nomination, frankly.
Warren, early. You know.
I don't think so. I'll answer the bigger question in a second, but I just think that, you know, if you look at Elizabeth Warren's her game, it's very narrow in a way. I think it's fascinating that Bernie has the best polling numbers with working class people and young people across all backgrounds. And Elizabeth Warren is just sort of performing basically exceptionally well with kind of like affluent white professionals. And I just don't – I think that the – and, you know, some people get sort of triggered by this, but I just think the reality is that Elizabeth Warren is – she's got some really good policy ideas and so on. And I think, and I can see some very clear demographics that she appeals to, but I think also so much of her momentum right now is sort of in a way artificially pushed by the media just because they hate Sanders so much and they want to use her to kind of triangulate against him. I just don't think at the end of the day, and obviously I could be wrong, I just don't see the type of movement and momentum and context for her amongst actual voters that I see around Sanders, even remotely. I just don't see it. And I'm also very concerned, frankly, about how she would do in a general election. So I do think, and, you know, this is early to tell and so on, but I think plenty of people on the left underestimate Biden, unfortunately. But I think it will come down to Sanders and Biden. And then, you know, the other question then becomes like, who is, you know, what happens at the convention? Do they try to, you know, and I would never say steal it in 2016. I mean, Bernie ran an incredible race and obviously there was bias. But, you know, that election wasn't stolen. Hillary Clinton got more votes than him. You know, it sucks. It's terrible. I certainly wish it weren't so. But I do think in this case, there could definitely be some, you know, funny nonsense at the convention if Bernie has the most delegates, but they can band together with enough other candidates to overtake him. So that would be what I would be concerned about. I don't actually think that I'm not that bullish about Warren.
Well,
frankly.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll see.
My feeling was early on that Warren's the effect of Warren's campaign would be to keep Sanders in the second position to help whoever the establishment candidate was going to be. That that wasn't maybe while she was running, but that would be the effect of her running. Or I sometimes would think in a conspiratorial way that that is why she was running. But now, I guess my thought is that there's a real race between Warren and Sanders, because the polls fluctuate, but
they're pulling from very different groups of voters. So I think it's very important in the media. You know, I'm really fed up with people drawing false equivalencies between them. You know, if you have any sort of like self-definition on the left, Sanders is clearly the left choice for a variety of reasons in terms of the fact that he is literally overall the furthest most left across the board on things like Medicare for All. Also, if you have an understanding of needing some type of broader coalition and movement behind a candidacy, and then when you incorporate foreign policy, then it becomes, I mean, actually really offensive and embarrassing that people would attempt to make that argument. But so it matters for us. Amongst the electorate, there's a lot more, you know, what's bizarre and interesting about the electorate is that Bernie Sanders could, you know, chop into 5-10% of Biden's voters, of whom a majority, you know, a lot of them, Bernie's the second choice of theirs, and then he wins the nomination. A lot of Warren voters are oscillating between her, Buttigieg, and Harris. And I think that that's actually quite revelatory about really the type of actual commitments that are taking place here. It's brand identity. It's not, you know, I don't think, and I think that's another sort of a real distinction is that that sort of like, we need to have a plan and she has a plan. That's a brand position. And I think that, you know, those voters are interested in different concepts like professionalism and technocracy and maybe the, you know, or the historical nature of having a woman elected president. I don't think, you know, it is interesting because Bernie supporters a lot of their second choice, many of them, their second choice is Warren. I think that they're much more, you know, contrary to all the sort of smears about his supporters, they're much more sort of ideologically cohesive and clear about what they're doing. Oh, you know what? You're right. You're right. I think it's Biden, then Warren. I think, again, that what people don't understand about Biden is that he is, first of all, that, you know, again, a lot of this stuff really is just impressionistic and people's sort of sensibilities about certain people. I do think that Biden, my guess would be is that in that specific case, those numbers will start to shift if he's run against them the same way, which is if you talk about his support for all these trade deals, if you support about really the fact that contrary to how this image he's carefully cultivated, he is not by any stretch of the imagination a blue collar advocate. But, you know, look, as far as the bigger question you asked, I mean, I think that if you had a world where Bernie Sanders was president, Jeremy Corbyn was prime minister, you annulled the 2018 elections in Brazil because they are quite literally illegitimate elections. The way I see it is that you would give the world system a fighting chance. That's how I see it. I think that that's really what it comes down to. That it will, you will have people in leadership positions who are trying to break the velocity of destruction and then attempt to generate a more humane and better world. And that is hugely significant because it opens, you know, it does open the space up for a longer term project to actually really try to kind of solve some of these structural problems. But I think it in the short term, there's not, you know, because the other major interventions, at least as of now, are moonshots or fantasy scenarios. Like, it's like, yes, maybe if there was a, you know, globally coordinated work stoppage, yes, that you know, something like that would probably be the most
powerful. But that's not that different than we should all storm Area 51. I mean, that's there's no groundwork for that. There's no, you can call a general strike all you like. There has to be a movement that's ready to strike, you know, and that's politically.
And I think for what it's worth, yeah, and I think what an incredible display of Sanders. I mean, Sanders is literally using his email list to support strikes. That has to be noted. I mean, that is totally unprecedented. That is no one has used an email list like that in a presidential campaign. Right. You can have email address. But there you go. So, yes, I think that getting a Sanders in that position, yes, of what is available and on tap in reality, I could not think of a greater intervention point.
Well, listen,
I couldn't.
I want to go from this high level kind of heart to heart conversation to more of a bullshit conversation in a way. So in other words, I'm going to ask you about the IDW, the intellectual dark web. the book that's going to come out with us is about that, but it's about a lot more than that. And the heart of it's about what we've been talking about so far. But I just want to ask you what your opinion is about what's happened to this IDW in the last year. And am I right in my assessment that it's sort of fallen apart? It's Bill Rogan's way off the reservation now. Ben Shapiro has turned into, he's always was a joke, but now he can't avoid the fact that he's a joke. I don't know about the Weinstein brothers, but Jordan Peterson was, I think, ultimately humiliated by Zizek and won't really recover as an anti-Marxist warrior after that.
Yeah, they've definitely had a really rough year, and I think part of it is just that look, Ben Shapiro was always Ben Shapiro, and Jordan Peterson obviously clearly had no basic grasp of a lot of the things he was making sweeping comments about. So really all it just took was a couple of people, you know, Zizek was absolutely masterful. And I think that did, amongst a certain group of people, have a big effect. I don't really know. I mean, certainly it didn't have a big effect on anything Peterson was saying, right? Like, Peterson is still out jetting around, and, you know, his being sort of pleasantly humiliated has had no effect on his thinking or evolution. And Ben Shapiro, you know, I mean, Ben Shapiro was always just, I mean, Ben Shapiro is literally just a, you know, aging teen conservative prodigy. And, you know, the notion that he was anything other than that was just due to marketing. My read is that they're having trouble as a group because, I mean, one is, I think, is the things we just outlined. Then I think there's also just repetition. You know, it's like, how many times can the same handful of people essentially have the same conversation again and again? And look, I'm not saying, I understand that we're all like in the same world and you and I have a lot of conversations as an example, and sure, there's overlap between them, but they're not literally the same conversation. You know, I mean, I have Richard Wolff on TMBS regularly, right? And so last time we talked about China, and we talked about, he gave us a primer on what primitive accumulation was. And the time before that, we talked about the Labor Party, and we talked about, if I had Richard Wolff on every single day or week or month and just, I don't know, complained about like one specific school of economists for 3 hours, and basically,
well, he would never do that.
I think there's a repetition,
right? There's the thing.
Of course, he would never do that.
I mean, you could have him on every day for a month or a year, and he would not run out of things to talk about, right?
Of course, because he's right. An actual intellectual. I mean, I think that also the other thing too is that there was a difficulty in the convergence when people started poking some holes, because you start getting different interest sets kicking in, you know, like Jordan Peterson, obviously, you know, he wouldn't do the PragerU stuff. He clearly has some, you know, very far right political proclivities. And then he's got this, you know, the self-help guru stuff. And then, you know, Dave Rubin basically, you know, he's so limited in what he has the capacity to do. And he clearly, you know, I think even Sam Harris said he's got some audience capture, right? Like he built an audience where it's going to be very hard for him to, you know, even pretend to occupy some type of disinterested centrist position. And he's, you know, and he's so, you know, he's dumb, so he can't really navigate that well. So he's just, you know, he's clearly, you know, he's just a Trump guy, right? It's just like, hey, you know, I support fill in the blank far right policy, but, you know, I'm gay. I mean, I think, you know, that luster was pretty easy. You know, Rogan for me, you know, Rogan's also just much more genuinely, and I don't necessarily mean this in a positive way always, but like he's heterodox. And I think in a way that, again, probably is worthy of thinking and critique, he is more representative of what, you know, like, you know how people on CNN or whatever will almost talk as if they're a stand-in for like the opinion of the commoner sometimes. And of course, that's so delusional. I think in some ways, Joe Rogan kind of is that, you know, really will go far right, sometimes fairly left. Then he totally clearly just sort of also responds to human personality. I mean, you know, if you sit down with Cornel West for 2 hours, you don't love Cornel West, you're a racist, or you have absolutely no soul whatsoever, you know? So I just think like with Rogan, I think that's very hard for people that are very ideologically oriented to actually get that, you know, there are people I know that are normal people that, you know, they like Bernie, they'd love to hear from Cornel West, but then they also will indulge all sorts of weird right-wing shit, and they're just all over the map. And a lot of it has to do with how you present information and how you position yourself, you know? So, yeah, and then Harris, I mean, Harris is amazing because in some ways I really do think Harris is in some respects the most reactionary and extreme and toxic of all of them, but it's very hard for him to, you know, he's got so little emotional intelligence. So I think it's very, you know, he occupies a very, very specialized place and weird little slice of the world. And I think he doesn't understand that he does, you know, so they're not, you know, it's easy to hang it together when you're not getting seriously critiqued and thought about. All you're doing is just, you know, sitting down and saying, oh, you know, college students, they're out of control, right? Yep, absolutely. Okay, let's do that for 4 hours again, you know?
That's that dog and pony show's wearing thin for sure. I feel as though that we're going to be seeing, as we approach the election, that all these players are going to be kind of get burnt up, that we're going to see a dumpster fire so huge in the 2020 election that we're all just going to be lucky to get the other side of it. But maybe I'm too much of a Cassandra.
Well, I think it does correlate, because I think that they're relevant, because I do think that to the extent to which we have a right wing in this country that still want, and globally that still wants to sort of not be overtly nationalist and claim to not want to be overtly racist. I mean, obviously that's, you know, there's a lot of that in the air there, but, you know, make that claim. They, that the arguments that these people have pioneered and deployed will still be what you hear across the board. You know, I think that that mode of I just had a debate with this guy, Destiny. Well, I heard a lot of whining that I didn't let him speak enough, but look, I'm alpha. I apologize. I didn't watch the other debates. I mean, I didn't appreciate him sort of framing the debate as sort of like a failure because he didn't assert himself enough and, you know, kind of whining about it. But I actually, you know, I like him. I think he's a smart guy. I don't have any bad feelings towards him at all. And I hope that, you know, in general, I'm actually interested in more kind of constructive bridges with people. But I notice like a legacy, and I don't think he's on the right. I do think he's on some sort of, you know, quasi, you know, center or whatever, you know, some type of democratic center or whatever. But I think there's certain areas that, you know, he's arguing in where you could see not IDW ideas specifically, but the legacy of that type of argumentation. So I think it's in, and in some ways it's very seductive, you know? And so I think these guys are in, I think they're in the milieu that way. And that might apply to somebody very much like Harris, that we'll see which way Harris goes. Like, I think if the Democrats nominate Bernie Sanders, I'm sure Harris will, you know, he won't endorse Trump, but he'll probably get behind some, you know, horrific, dumb oligarch campaign. And I think he's very sympathetic to Andrew Yang, which is, of course, you know, quite evocative of his just delusional politics. But I think, you know, and then I do think in the others, my guess would be with Peterson and, you know, and obviously Rubin, to the extent Rubin is anything other than a joke, I think those projects will just get much more explicitly Trumpian. And I don't, and I would guess too, like I would guess this time that Shapiro will probably formally endorse Trump because there isn't really room for that brand anymore. I mean, that kind of never Trump brand, there's only a couple of slots left for that. And those people have like MSNBC contributorships. As a mass market and you're primarily, or a micro market working on the internet and so on, there isn't that space because again, you know, there's no difference. Trump is a Republican. There's no difference policy-wise between Shapiro and Trump. It's just a question of Trump might pretend to care about workers more than Shapiro, and Shapiro sort of doesn't like as much overt racism, although I don't even really see that either. So I think that we have to understand this moment and the directions that we'll go in as part of a larger trend that we'll be dealing with for decades. But this sort of, I mean, you know, again, they'll try to relaunch it and, you know, revitalize it, I think, probably in some shape or form in the next couple of months. I know one of the Weinstein brothers has his own show now, which is pretty funny. But
yeah, and his first guest was Brett Andy Weinstein. No.
Yeah, and also Peter Thiel, right? And of course, that was hysterical. I mean, I believe he works for Peter Thiel.
Oh, wait.
And they share so many of the same ideological
podcasts. The guy from Evergreen, but his brother is Eric Weinstein, who worked for Peter Thiel. So, do they both have shows now?
Oh wait, I thought Eric had the show, not Brett. I can't tell the difference. Brett's the one who left. Brett's the Evergreen, and then Eric's the one who works for Thiel. Okay, right. And Brett has the show. So anyways, yeah, I mean, but Brett did have Peter Thiel on, and it was just very funny because I caught a few. I will admit I have not watched barely any of the show, but I caught a few minutes of Brett sort of saying, like, you know, basically of Brett and Peter basically, you know, being shocked that they agree with each other on so many things because one of them's a Democrat, one of them's a Republican. It's like, and, you know, that's actually another kind of thing that's funny about their whole shtick is I do think that it's very it's a very antiquated frame right now, because I do think as, you know, again, ideas that I think are perfectly at home in the Republican Party but don't get branded as Republican are pushed to the front, like, you know, overtly fascist and reactionary ideas. And then also some democratic socialist and Marxist ideas come into the frame. And I think, you know, more and more Americans definitely have some sense that, you know, there's some type of permanent class in various elite institutions, and people could, you know, Democrats or whatever. And it really makes absolutely no difference on the big fundamental issues. It's such an antiquated way of what it's like, oh, yes, but maybe maybe you don't think all poor kids should be fed into a blood bank. I only think that one out of every two should, you know. It's like, okay, shocking.
Eric Weinstein was very revelatory in an interview with, I think it was not Joe Rogan, but some other like small time podcaster I saw him do. It's like, again, it was, he came up on my YouTube feed while I was washing the dishes. I think it was the same episode that I may have talked to you about before. But one of the things he said in that was, we've got to come to a point where people who are liberals and people who are conservatives understand that, you know, they have more in common with their friends on the other side of the political aisle at the country club than they do with the extremes of their own party.
That's very astute. That is very astute. There's no doubt that you have more in common with a fellow member of the country club than you do probably with almost anybody else of any other party. That's a very,
right,
wow,
right.
What an accidentally Marxist revelation he just had.
But he was saying, which is why the left needs to disavow, you know, liberals, the sensible part of the left needs to, the country club left, they need to disavow Antifa, just like the right needs to disavow, the president of the United States.
Right. I mean, that's also such a, you know, that I just want to say, by the way, I am talking about Eric Weinstein. His show is called The Portal with Eric Weinstein. Yes. So I am talking about Eric. I didn't even know Brett had a show. I mean, you know, between them, it's just so much charisma. But I think that the that's another great, right. Like, yeah, how can you possibly have a serious conversation about disavowing quote unquote extremes on one side when one extreme is the president of the United States who heads your party and the other extreme is like, well, frankly, I mean, a lot of like sort of former dumpster divers never took a boxing class. But anyway, I'm just kidding. All love to Antifa. All love to Antifa. But they are so profoundly unhelpful with that too, because, you know, another theme that commonly happens with these IDW types is that even the things that they kind of vaguely put a finger on that might be worth talking about, it's people on the actual left who are trying to navigate them in a good faith way and actually deal with them. So even if we have like a serious conversation about Antifa and strategy and tactics and so on, Sam Harris running around saying that, you know, white supremacy basically doesn't exist is, you know, again, it's both utterly wrong and delusional and also actually profoundly unhelpful, because a lot of people, when they hear that type of rhetoric, rightfully, their backs get up because it flies in the face of reality. I played a clip of Sam Harris recently. Sam Harris, who's like major contribution to justifying any number of just like obscene ideas about Islam and foreign policy, was essentially just going around saying like, hey, you know, ISIS says it, so believe it. Now when confronted with, you know, just on a complexity level, like figuring out why the Christchurch terrorist went in and massacred those people in the mosque does not require, like, it happened contemporaneously and he released a manifesto that clearly outlined why he did what he did, right? So Sam Harris banks a whole career off of making these, you know, sweeping generalizations over a billion people, thousands of years of history, based off of texts he cannot read in their original language, all of this stuff. He's going on talking about like you know, we don't really, you know, well, I mean, the Christchurch thing is also, you know, there's all this shit posting on 4chan and it's amazing. You're listening to it. And you're like, you know, on one hand, wow, you are an unbelievable fucking dunce to, you know, not be able to deduce clear ideological reasons here. And then you've been, you know, built your whole career on Islam like that. And then on the other hand, it's like, great. Maybe you could apply some of this thinking to the actual far more hard one to figure out. And in both cases, you know, of course, what's completely missing from his analysis is a broader understanding of alienation. That I want to say briefly, Doug, I know that we don't have as much time, but one of the things that I've been finding helpful in conversation recently is actually really making clear that when I talk about, as an example, with terrorism or radicalization, and I do want to just say that, frankly, like, I do spend time talking with people and, you know, engaging with people who do like actual work on de-radicalization. So it's not all just like, you know, theory to me. I mean, maybe this theory to me, but I'm talking to people who have real experience on the field, and I'll leave it at that, including a very close friend and collaborator. And, but that when I mean alienation, I don't, that there's people who dismiss alienation and people who use alienation in a very simple, like one-to-one way, which is that it's basically just economic insecurity. And obviously economic insecurity and deprivation is very important, but we need to get back to, you know, this much broader full spectrum understanding of alienation, I think, in order to even tease apart some of these, you know, really important conversations that people are obsessed with, like, you know, is it class or is it identity or so on? Alienation includes all of these variables and really just speaks to people who feel alienated from the means and processes of their own lives. I mean, that's a very broad category. It's not just they're broke.
I mean, right. And there's there are different levels of alienation. I mean, there's like the strict economic idea of alienation that Marx talked about, but then there's also this other kind of alienation where you're not just alienated on the job, but you don't have a life. You don't have any social connections. You have precarity, and you also have no sense of belonging in the world. And that's more and more common, but that's the one that's really dangerous. I mean, the kind of alienation on the job, if you kind of get caught on to what's going on the job and how you're alienated from your own labor, you could organize and resist with people who you are socially connected to, right? That's a different kind of alienation.
Right. And so all of those things are part of a kind of integral approach to understand, you know, why somebody radicalizes or something like that. And it's just, you know, but it's just hysterical to watch Sam Harris go from, you know, there's nothing to understand really when it comes to Islam, whether it's the material conditions of foreign policy and ideological development with like the Mujahideen in the 1980s and that whole, I mean, just even that history alone, you can't understand a group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS without understanding that history. And then also the, you know, and then the, you know, of course, that this incredibly ornate, you know, tradition that spans all sorts of contexts is just one thing. Just a bunch of bad ideas. And then not to mention and then also totally dismissing the Scott Atran work, where Scott Atran, whether you like him or not, he literally works ethnographically with people who fight in these organizations. And then after just arrogantly and densely and catastrophically asserting that again and again and again and again, all of a sudden the ascendancy of this new phase of white nationalist terrorism, now all of a sudden it's like, well, you can't just read the text. You gotta think subtextually about shitposting. It's like, you can't think subtextually about, you know, the billions of dollars put to spread the Salafist interpretation of Islam. That's just liberal bullshit. But you sure can think subtextually about what one fucking terrorist did in his manifesto. I mean, how people take Sam Harris seriously is still just, I just still find that just fucking awe-inspiring. I don't get it. I don't.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would just say that obviously the approach to fighting terrorism has to be not the Sam Harris approach. I mean, the one that he uses when he's talking about Islam. Because if you're just trying to fight a bad idea, those ideas aren't coming from nowhere, and they're always being generated by a historical process. And if you don't change that, you're going to end up with the same shit. Having said that, there are real, you know, Nazis out there, and we have to stop them before they blow up buildings or shoot people up. All right. Well, listen, I feel like we've got plenty here, but I'm going to stop recording. I probably won't leave my little